Mystical Songs by Ralph Vaughan Williams. Sir David Wilcox conducted the choir of King's College Cambridge in the English Chamber Orchestra, and the baritone soloist was the late John Shirley Quirk, who died on April the 7th. A fine artist and a great champion of British music, particularly that of Benjamin Britten. Well, that's all for this morning. I hope you have an enjoyable Easter break. Don't eat too much chocolate. And I look forward to your company next Sunday when I have another Beethoven violin sonata for you, a whole series of operatic fantasies, which I'm reattaching to the arias on which they're based. And I'll also be playing recordings by one of the loveliest soprano voices to come out of Wales, Dame Margaret Price. You can hear her in Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Wagner and Richard Strauss. So do get honing any anecdotes about Dame Margaret. All that and more from 9 next Sunday.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. Studio production this morning was by Neil Miners. Well, from those mystical songs to murder and a certain amount of mayhem in ancient Rome tonight.
The long day's task is done and we must sleep.
Drama on 3 presents Kenneth Branagh and Alex Kingston in Antony and Cleopatra by William Shakespeare.
My master and my lord, I must obey.
Lovers, politicians, superstars.
I am fire and air.
My great office will sometimes divide me from your bosom.
As empires clash around them.
I hear the doom of Egypt.
Their destiny seems inevitable.
I must from this enchanting queen break off.
Whilst he stood up and spoke,
Antony,
he was my master.
Kenneth Branagh and Alex Kingston star in a new production of Antony and Cleopatra by William Shakespeare. This evening at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Welcome to Rome.
Thank you.
This is Radio 3. In an hour from now, a chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert we broadcast live from Wigmore Hall on Radio 3. The pianist Valentina Lisica plays sonatas by Beethoven and Liszt, his monumental sonata in B minor. That's at 1. And then the Early Music Show delves into Radio 3's 18th century season with a look at three depictions of life in that time by Hogarth and reflects on their musical references. That's the Early Music Show at 2 this afternoon here on Radio 3. But now at midday, it's time for Private Passions. And this week, Michael Barclay's guest is the director of the National Gallery in London, Nicholas Penny, who takes Michael on a private after-hours tour of the gallery.
For this special Easter edition of Private Passions, I've come to the National Gallery to talk to its director, the distinguished art historian, Nicholas Penny. We're beginning in a wonderful space of glittering gold, dozens of gilded frames of Italian altarpieces. There's so much here, it's almost overwhelming, so it's wonderful to be with someone who really knows these paintings so intimately. Nicholas, we've asked you for this Easter programme to choose paintings on an Easter theme of death and rebirth. And we're starting here in the Sainsbury Wing with these early Italian paintings of the crucifixion. Now, when you come up from your office at the end of the day, all of the visitors have gone, I wonder if they're still in some way revealing themselves to you.
Oh, yes, and in fact, they often mean more to me because the lights take some time to go on, and sometimes they don't come on at all. So you see things that you're familiar with in one light in a completely different and dimmer light. That's actually very important with the early paintings with gold backgrounds, and they have a completely different life. And they were paintings which were made to be seen half-seen in natural light, I was going to say leaking into the church, because, I mean, they were very often very dark churches, which would suddenly be transformed by a few candles flickering, and then sometimes by masses of candles. So these paintings were made for different types of lighting.
Well, we've come to one picture which I know you're particularly proud of. There's something quite spectacularly individual about it, isn't there?
Well, there is. It's a painting of the crucifixion by Jacopo di Cioni. It's a painting actually showing everything that went on the crucifixion, the good and the bad thief having their legs broken. It shows you the vinegar being raised up to Christ, and so on. And it's also got its original frame, a canopy across the top, and underneath the canopy you can still see the gold stars on a blue background. You can only see that now if you sink down on your knees, which slightly some people might find that disconcerting. But in the right in the middle, the Virgin is fainting. This was a matter of great theological debate, the so-called spasimo, or fainting of the Virgin, because she was said to have been standing at the foot of the cross, so she shouldn't have fainted. And it's interesting that artists at this date tend to show her fainting but standing at the same time, being held up. I know this seems like a sort of trivial thing, but it was a huge theological significance. So there are other moments when she was thought to have fainted. And the Dominicans were very upset about this because they thought she was really tough, the Virgin, and she wouldn't have fainted, wouldn't have passed out. But the Franciscans were very keen that she was fainting all the time. And they had a spot in where pilgrims went in the Holy Land where they actually showed where she'd fainted. Anyway, this becomes a great theme, the fainting of the Virgin. Very often, paintings of the crucifixion are actually paintings of Christ on the cross and the Virgin fainting at the same time.
Of course, your first choice of music, the Rossini Stabat Mater, is a much later creation, although the Stabat Mater itself goes back to Gregorian plainchant.
Yes, well, it's a medieval hymn. So although it's anachronistic, it is in a way highly appropriate because the artist who created this work in the 14th century, he would have known these same words.
Thank you. Thank you.
the opening of Rossini's Stabat Mater, with Antonio Pappano conducting the orchestra and choir of the National Academy of Santa Cecilia. How does that speak to you, that music? Indeed, how does music affect you genuinely? Is it a very important part of your life?
This music does move me very much, and there's a reason for it too, actually, which is I do love opera. I've come to love opera, actually, because my wife is a great lover of opera, a great lover of Rossini, in fact. And so this is very operatic. And I do dislike the idea that some people have that that's a bad thing. I don't see why religious music shouldn't be operatic. But it's extraordinary the way it creeps up on you and explodes. That I do really love about it.
Do you find suddenly you hear things which maybe you didn't know? I mean, one of the things, for example, walking around the gallery before we started, for me, was I came across three painters. I just mentioned them, Saroldo, Zubaran, and Sasso Ferrate. And I was completely knocked out by these paintings, which weren't by El Greco or by Rubens or Titian. And you realise how much else there is to discover, and that's true of music as well.
Yes, I do actually wish that people were more aware of the fact that there are great paintings by artists who weren't necessarily great or aren't today great names. So this sense of going to the National Gallery as a place to discover things rather than what I think is the chief reason people go there, which is to see what they've already seen in reproduction. That's also a very, very good reason for going to the National Gallery, but the idea that you might actually discover something completely new there is very, very important for me.
Well, Nicholas Penny, we've ended up in front of one of the great names of art, Titian, and this painting is probably one of the most famous of all his pieces.
Yes, this is a painting of Bacchus and Ariadne, and what it actually represents is Ariadne abandoned by Theseus on the island, and she's just wandering dishevelled on the shore, and suddenly there's a rout of terrible... It's a terrifically noisy picture. Bacchus and his intoxicated companions are arriving with all their clamour and clatter and music. So she's very alarmed. And then Bacchus leaps from his chariot, and in the ancient poetry, which Titian would have been following, He just says, you know, and his foot sunk into the sand. She fell into his arms. You just can't resist a god. I've heard people say that this is a painting about falling in love, but actually, I mean, rarely. It is about the behaviour of gods and about extraordinary things that change your life. In the sky, there are the stars, and eventually Ariadne was turned into the stars. I mean, Bacchus actually says to her, you know, actually, it's going to be great. I'll turn you into a constellation eventually. I mean, you know...
Death and transfiguration.
Death and transfiguration. Yes, and that is an important part of the painting. It's about that.
Well, we're going to put some of the images on our website. If you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website and click on the word gallery, you can look at what Nicholas Penny is describing.
And you'll almost certainly be re-looking at it because it's such a familiar picture, but you'll perhaps see it in a different way. I mean, this, of course, is very famously the subject of an opera by Richard Strauss, and that is also actually treats the subject as both comedy and tragedy, as lyrical and grotesque. So it has something of the complication, I think, that Titian expected. And we're going to hear this rhapsodic love duet.
Yes, almost Tristan-like.
And actually, we're going to hear Jessie Norman, and I do love her voice very much.
Thank you.
Jesse Norman as Ariadne and Paul Frey as Bacchus, performing the final duet from Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos. Kurt Mazur was conducting the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig. And you can find details of all the music that we're playing on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Well, now we've come behind the scenes, if you like, at the National Gallery to one of the conservation studios, a rather wonderful space, because on one side you've got what looks rather like the interior of a 19th century chemist with lots of potions and different colours in jars, cadmium, blue, that kind of thing. And then on the other, there are all these easels and works in progress. What's this one?
Well, this is a mysterious panel painting. It shows the dead Christ, his body supported by two angels. They even seem to be holding up the body so you can see the wounds in it. It's a tragic, even a terrible image in some ways. It's very beautifully painted. We don't know the artist. We don't think it's a great picture, but we think it's a good picture and we'd like to know more about it. It is clear that it's a better picture than we thought, now that all its old, very old, varnish has been removed. So a kind of resurrection, if you like, of the dead takes place all the time in a great institution like this.
I wonder whether you get the same kind of pleasure from seeing something unveiled like that that I get from going and seeing a Beethoven or a Stravinsky manuscript and seeing how it was done, how it was put together.
I find it extremely fascinating to know more about how paintings were actually made. And of course, modern technology has transformed this. In my lifetime, I suppose the most important thing is infrared reflectography, which enables you to study the underdrawing, which the artist certainly never knew you'd see. I mean, in previous generations, it was X-ray, which still is tremendously revealing.
Let's return from the visual to the oral for your next piece of music, which takes us, if you like, in terms of the gallery, into a 20th century room.
Yes, I'm rather crazy about Walton's Facade. I do love poetry, and I quite like nonsense poetry, actually. And this is a higher class of nonsense poetry, surrealist poetry, actually, by Edith Sitwell. I think she published the poems before Walton, who was something of a protege of hers, put them to music. And it's lyrical and moving, really.
Actually, you know, you're talking about how things are put together. It's fabulously orchestrated.
It is, and I love the music, actually. It's quite as much as Edith's weird voice.
I gather you know quite a lot of poetry, and particularly this by heart.
I do. And actually, when I say it to myself, I think I tend to get it wrong. Heliogabalus lost his head, but dust is on the brightest wing, and dust forbids the birds to sing. Tra-la-la-la-la. But I'm sure it's much better than that, and we'll hear it in a moment.
Lady, silly and shady, long to be a lazy lady, walk by the cupola's gables in the lake's Georgian stables. In a fairy tale like the heat intense and the mist in the woods, when across the fence the children gathering strawberries are changed by the heat into negresses. Their fair hair shines there like gold-haired planets, Calliope, Io, Pomona, Antiope, Echo and Clio. Then Lily O'Grady, silly and shady, sauntered along like a lazy lady. Beside the way, she cocks her gown with tatters of satin, the colour of shining green dapple. Her fondly rolled parasol was a great gold sun, all the haycock shining. But she was a negress, black as the shade, the time on the brightest lady laid. Then a satyr dog-haired as trunks of trees began to flatter, began to tease. And she ran like the nymphs with golden foot that trampled the strawberry buttercup root in the thick go-dew as bite as the mesh of dead Penelope's golden flesh. Made from the music whence were born Memphis and Thebes in the first hot morn, and ran to wake in the lake where the water ripple seemed made to rake. And Charlottine, Adeline, round rose bubbling Victorine, and the other fish express a wish for mastic mantles and gowns with a swish, and bright and slight as the poses of buttercups and of roses, and buds of the wildwood lilies, they chase her as frisky as billies. The red retriever head satyr can whine and tease her and flatter, but Lily O'Grady, silly and shady, in the deep shade is a lazy lady. Now Pomp is dead, Homer's red, Heliogabalus lost his head, and shade is on the brightest wing, and dust forbids the birds to sing.
Peter Peers performing Edith Sitwell's words in the popular song from William Walton's Facade. Anthony Collins conducting the English Opera Group ensemble. Does that sound dated to you, the music, or...?
I think it's absolutely marvellous.
It's a tricky piece to do, funnily enough, rhythmically quite demanding.
I can well believe it. I mean, stumble over Heliogabalus is in itself a very easy thing to do.
I get the impression that you rather like works that, in a sense, kick against the trend. On the other hand, you've been quite dismissive of some contemporary art.
I think it's a really good thing to be dismissive of some contemporary art, because I can't believe... I mean, I find it very odd that people should sort of, almost like a sort of religious faith, believe in art of a certain period being superior to any other. So I'm sort of have a critical and sceptical view of art of all periods. I would say that, I mean, there's much contemporary art that I like. It's quite difficult to keep up with it all and very difficult to sympathise with it all. But I do, what one of the things I do is I like to remind people that actually they better really like it, because I don't like the idea of them liking it because they should like it. They really should like it.
Do you think the market in sort of, for example, conceptual art has slightly distorted our ability to look at it for what it really is?
Oh, totally. The huge values attached to work of art make people think, gosh, you know, must be something really special about it, but there's no reason why that should be so. And museum endorsement, of course, is another thing that's happened. I would find that very frightening. So I'm quite pleased in a way that the National Gallery shows contemporary art but doesn't actually acquire it. I would find acquiring it a very difficult thing to do.
Are you enamoured, then, of the blue cockerel that sits outside your gallery?
I find its very synthetic character disturbing. Of course, I'm sure it's meant to be disturbing in the relationship with the rest of the square, but I must say its scale is very good. It's just the right size of thing to be on top of the plinth. I much prefer it to many of the other things that have been on top of the plinth.
You've spent most of your career in Britain, but you had a few years in Washington at the National Art Gallery, didn't you? And I wonder whether there are sounds which, for you, are sort of quintessentially English.
Well, there are. When I was there, I remember going to see Gosford Park, and that opening passage with all that pouring rain. I was terribly moved because there was a tremendous amount of blackbird. You don't hear those birds so clearly in America. So for me, after that moment, or around that time, you know, I began to yearn for blackbirds. And as a result, when I've come back to England, I've been, you know, every morning I'm very disappointed if I don't see Mr. or Mrs. Blackbird in my garden. The life of blackbirds has become very important to me. I think they're the most beautiful bird, actually, in that simple
sort
of way.
And fine songbirds, too.
Wonderful songbirds, yeah. It's extraordinary. They're very versatile. Can we hear a blackbird?
Of course, some composers have used literal birdsong, Messiaen's obvious example, but other composers are just wonderful at conjuring up nature in an abstract sense. And I think probably the next pieces you've chosen, part of Britain's A Midsummer Night's Dream and the wonderful aria I Know a Bank. And the interesting thing about this, I think, is the way Britain uses a countertenor to conjure up an unreal world.
And I think that is a response to something that you can find in Shakespeare. It suits the haunting and haunted character of the poetry.
Welcome, wanderer! Hast thou a flower there?
Alfred Deller singing Oberon in Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, and we heard Britten himself conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Well, we've moved into a room which many visitors to the National Gallery will know because it's dominated by the famous Solar Bathers. Wonderful picture, actually. But you've brought us not to that, but to another picture, a landscape, and I think a very poetic one.
Yeah, this is a painting by Galan Kalela. It's the only Finnish painting in the National Gallery. It was bought in 1999. And honestly, I think no one had heard of this artist at all. But he was a leading painter in Finland and known quite extensively in Europe in around 1900. But this picture has become enormously popular. It's one of our best-selling postcards. So it is a very, very powerful image because it shows a lake, reflections of an island on the lake with trees on it and with clouds reflected in the still waters of the lake, and then something's passed across the surface of the lake in a kind of zigzag. It's an effect of breeze. But when you see it, you think something's passed over the surface of the water. If you like, it's a slightly spooky, slightly spine-chilling effect to see this, and suddenly it's really captured the popular imagination.
It does sort of draw one into itself, almost in the way that sometimes looking down from a tall building you get sort of vertigo. So there's something that pulls you into the water.
Yes, there is. I quite agree.
Well, this is a very different landscape we're going to go to now, Nicholas Penny. It's the landscape of James Joyce, but it still has an element of regeneration to it.
Yes, it's a passage from the end of The Dead. And, of course, this is a landscape which is a landscape of memory, and it's written in a very, very beautiful way, which, of course, in a way anticipates some of the extraordinary innovations in Ulysses. I mean, I think The Dead is one of the finest things written in English in the 20th century. I can't read it too much, or rather, I wish I had more time to read it again and again.
A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead.
Stephen Ray reading the end of James Joyce's The Dead, the final story in Dubliners, the lowest point of sorrow and a vision of the world from the perspective of the dead. Well, for our final location here in the National Gallery, Nicholas Penny, you've brought me to a painting of hope and resurrection. It's again by Titian, his painting about Easter and the risen Christ, the scene from the Bible where Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene after he's risen from the dead.
Yes, I'm interested in the history of the National Gallery, and there's a very interesting fact about this painting, is that when the gallery had no paintings in it at all, during the Second World War, but it was still a place of cultural resort because of the music that was played here. The idea occurred to, or was suggested to, the then director, Kenneth Clark, that he should bring back one or two portable pictures which could be taken down into safe storage in the event of an air raid. And the first painting that he chose, he actually claimed that it was by public request, but we're not sure. Lots of people actually wrote in, but he chose this painting first of all, and I think that the reason he did that is because it's a religious episode which is extremely accessible to everyone, because anyone who's lost someone that they love, anyone who's mourning for someone who's dead, is likely to have those terrible dreams when they seem to be alive again, and there's some sort of encounter. It's an extremely common experience. And to me, this particular episode and the strangeness of the story where Mary Magdalene actually thinks it's a gardener and then realizes that it is her beloved Christ who is actually risen from the dead. I hope I'm not sort of upsetting anyone by saying that actually this kind of registers, this sudden change. This is very dreamlike. It's very the sort of thing that happens to you in dreams. You think you're talking to someone else, and then suddenly you realize that actually into the dream has come someone who you loved and who is no longer there. So anyway, it's an amazing painting. It's one of the best illustrations ever by an artist of an actual verbal exchange. And because it's not just illustrating the moment where Christ says, don't touch me. It's a moment when she acknowledges that it is Christ. And all that's done by movements of the hand, the exchange of glances, and the movements of the bodies of the figures and the way they look at each other is enhanced in the most extraordinary way by the landscape.
It's called Noli Me Tangere, as you were saying, do not touch me, in case somebody's looking on the website for this. It's a very touching picture and a rather wonderful one to think about on this day of all days.
Yes, of course, that's partly why I've chosen it, although it is really definitely one of my favourite paintings in the National Gallery, and I think one of the greatest paintings in the gallery. And I thought it appropriate to end with Handel's Messiah. I have to say something, I mean, again, when we began this programme, we were talking about the Stabat Mater as something which has a continuous life throughout the centuries. I think it's a very, very interesting thing about this particular piece of music that it has been a continuous performance, and I know changed a very great deal from what Handel intended with all those massive choirs and massive orchestration which he didn't intend, but it's something terribly moving that this piece of music has been played so continuously. And there's another thing about it too, which is actually the words are extremely powerful, because when they were first adapted by Charles Jennings, they themselves had a tremendous echo to them, because they were from the King James version of the Bible, they were from the Book of Common Prayer, so they were not written in the century in which Handel's Messiah was actually performed. They came from the past, and of course they recall a more distant past of the Gospels.
And a tenuous connection with Joyce, because it was first performed in Dublin.
Yes, I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I was preparing for this. You'd say you always learn something when you're preparing to be totally spontaneous on occasions like this.
Well, Nicholas Penny, thank you very much for being totally spontaneous and for inviting me here to the wonderful National Gallery to share your private passions.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
The opening numbers of Part 3 of Handel's Messiah. Colin Davis was conducting the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, and the soloists were Margaret Price and Simon Estes. Michael Barclay was talking to the director of London's National Gallery, Nicholas Penny. And you might like to know that you can download this programme and many others from the series if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest will be the writer and broadcaster Jonathan Meads. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
Afternoon on 3 celebrates British music. Beginning tomorrow, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the BBC Singers and the Ulster Orchestra perform some of the key works from Britain's best-loved composers. From Tasman Little playing Walton's Violin Concerto to Sir Andrew Davis conducting Britain, we've got the cream of British talent performing works new and old. And there are two major works for chorus and orchestra by Elgar, The Dream of Gerontius on Monday and The Apostles on Thursday. Join me, Penny Gore, for British music in Afternoon on 3, weekdays from 2 o'clock, or catch up with Every Note via the Radio 3 website.
And that's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's a minute past 1 o'clock now. Time for the news with Ian Skelly.
Reports from Russia say 5 people have been killed in an attack on a pro-Russian checkpoint in eastern Ukraine. The foreign ministry in Moscow said it was outraged by the deaths and accused the Ukrainian government of breaching an Easter truce. Some relatives of passengers missing after the ferry disaster in South Korea have clashed with police. They say they're angry at the slow pace of the recovery operation. About 250 people, mostly teenagers, are still unaccounted for. The leaders of the Catholic and Anglican churches have delivered their traditional Easter messages. The Pope condemned what he called the immense wastefulness of the world while many went hungry. The Archbishop of Canterbury in his address focused on the religious significance of Easter and the plight of the disadvantaged. Ofsted's chief inspector in England, Sir Michael Wilshaw, is to take personal responsibility for its investigation of schools in Birmingham, alleged to have been the target of infiltration by people with extreme Islamic views. He'll go to the city this week to finalise reports by his inspectors. A businessman appointed by the Prime Minister to chair a quango managing public loans has resigned after newspapers revealed he'd been declared bankrupt. A Conservative spokesman said Tony Caplin should have told ministers about his financial situation. Labour called the revelation astonishing. Two agencies of the Scottish Government have become the latest organisations to quit the CBI over its opposition to independence. Scottish Enterprise and the tourism body Visit Scotland said they were given no choice after the CBI registered to join the No campaign. Four French journalists held hostage in Syria for nearly a year have been welcomed home by President Hollande. France has denied paying a ransom. And the weather: scattered showers across parts of southern and eastern England will die out this afternoon, but a band of heavy rain along the south coast will then move slowly northwards, reaching parts of South Wales and the Midlands by this evening. Elsewhere, it'll be staying dry with some long, sunny spells. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 3 minutes past one.
And that was Ian Skelly. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. And it's time now for our lunchtime concert and a second chance to hear last Monday's broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. The visitor this time was the Ukrainian pianist Valentina Lisitsa. She played just two works in her programme, Liszt's mighty B minor sonata and, to begin with, Beethoven's piano sonata in D minor, Opus 31, No. 2, which was published in 1801. It's a work with a very pressing and distinctive emotional character. And when Beethoven was asked by someone what it all meant, he said to have replied, "Read the Tempest." No one knows if he was being meaningful or just evasive, but the idea has stuck, and the Tempest has long been the work's nickname. Here it is then, played by Valentina Lisitsa.